It is, as we all know, a very tense time for relations between the United States and Nicaragua. It is for this very reason that it is so essential to establish a dialogue between our two countries, to replace misunderstandings and the Contras with positive relations and peace. We thank you for coming tonight to further this difficult but important process. And now I'd like to present Professor Abram Shays, the Felix Frankfurter Professor of Law at Harvard, who was a member of the legal team representing Nicaragua in its successful World Court case. Professor Shays?
Thank you, Jim. I'm really delighted to be here tonight. It is a great pleasure to welcome and to introduce Sergio Ramirez, the Vice President of Nicaragua. Now, Americans have a very distinct and well-defined image of what a Vice President is. Well, I think you all ought to look at and listen to Sergio tonight so you can see what a vice president might be. We had quite an escort walking over here tonight, and it struck me that, Sergio, when you go for a walk in Managua, I don't think you have as many cops and Secret Service people around you as we had walking from Pound over here to Austin Hall. Vice President Ramirez's appearance, not only here but in the United States, is in one sense the culmination of a six-year struggle to get to exercise your First Amendment rights to hear him and others about the Nicaraguan question, because for 6 years he's been trying to get here, and the authorities in the United States have been denying him a visa. When I first went to Nicaragua in 1984 to talk about taking on the Nicaragua case in the World Court, I learned that Nicaragua is one of the few countries in the Western Hemisphere where you don't need a visa to get in. You can just go there. Vice President Ramirez is now in his mid-40s, 44 years old. When I first went to Nicaragua, which was, as I said, only a couple of years ago, and I looked around, I thought, my goodness, you know, here are my law students running this country. It was really wonderful. You looked around, and the people who had authority and responsibility, which they had won the hard way in that government, were young people who were engaged in the work of building their country, and among them, Sergio was sort of an older and wiser head. He was then, what, 39? Okay. By that time, by the time that Somoza, the Somoza government was overthrown, he had been working at it for 20 years because he began his opposition to the Somozan government when he was a student, a law student, at the University of Nicaragua in 1959. Now, I want to talk to all of you law students who suppose that there's nothing to do with a legal education but to go down to Wall Street, because this law student went out of law school to take a major hand in the work that there was to be done in his own country. And besides that, found time to become one of the leading Latin American literary personalities and authors. So all of you ought to think about that When you say that there really is no choice after you get out of law school, you've got to go to some place like Cravath or something like that. Sergio was close to Carlos Fonseca, who was one of the founders of the FSLN, or the Sandinista Party. And as part of his early work for the party, he collected the papers and writings and sayings of Sandino, the legendary resistor to American intervention in the 20s, after whom the Sandinista movement was named. He published those writings in a book called The Living Thought of Sandino. Those materials were, in fact, an expression of nationalism, Nicaraguan nationalism, but not only nationalism. It was a poor man's nationalism. It was a nationalism suffused with a drive for social justice in Nicaragua. And Sandino's writings, in fact, provided the text for the struggle in Nicaragua against Somoza. I think it's of great importance for us to think about that for a little while. I suppose most of us know that the Sandinista movement was named after Sandino. But we Americans, even we Americans sitting here at Harvard, tend to be very ahistorical in our view of the world. When we talk about policy with regard to Nicaragua or wherever else it is in the world, we tend to think of it in very contemporary terms, as though this is a chessboard and we're moving pieces around on the chessboard, and this is all a kind of very well-defined set of forces that are being maneuvered in whatever theater it is. In fact, of course, if you sit in Nicaragua, U.S. policy is seen against a history of continuous intervention in the affairs of Nicaragua, beginning in 1858, when a freebooter named Charles Walker or William Walker came down and established his personal rule in Nicaragua. And his first act was to restore slavery in Nicaragua. Now, if you live in a country that has been occupied in one way or another by U.S. interests from 1858 on, you can have your reasons for suspecting the benign motivations of U.S. policy, or even the neutral motivations of U.S. policy. You see that policy in a historic context that we know very little about. The one thing you can tell about U.S. policy is all the places where the Marines were play baseball. The only countries in the world that play baseball are places that have been subjected to U.S. military occupation. Nicaragua and Cuba play baseball. In fact, you may have read that the young soldier who shot down the plane that Hasenfus was in was honored by being permitted to throw out the first ball in the Nicaraguan baseball season. When I talk, though, about the angle of vision, the perspective with which a Nicaraguan would look at U.S. policy, I shouldn't confine myself to Nicaragua, because what is true of Nicaragua is true, generally speaking, of people all over Latin America.
And when we think about our own policies in that region and what we need to do to have effective policies in that region, we should remember that whatever we think of our motivations, whatever we think of our high-minded and idealistic pretensions, it may look very different if you've been on the receiving end of American policy in Latin America for more than 100 years. Well, to take up again with our speaker tonight, after he put together these Sandino papers, which led me into my little digression. He was active in the anti-Somoza movement until in the mid-70s he really had to get out, and he left for West Germany for the early part of the 70s and the mid-70s, and he returned to Nicaragua in 1978, I think, as a founder and member of the Group of 12. Now, I don't know whether you know what the Group of 12 was. These were not people who went around in fatigues and stayed out in the jungle. This was a group of prominent professional and business people, actually, religious leaders, who sort of moved the Nicaraguan Revolution from a guerrilla armed struggle into a national rising. And they were, in some sense, the return of the Group of 12 to Nicaragua, where they were all subject to arrest. That is, warrants for their arrest were outstanding when they returned. That moment was a catalytic moment in the Nicaraguan revolution. After the overthrow of Nicaragua, of Somoza in 1979, Sergio Ramirez was a member of the ruling junta, and in 1948 he was elected vice president. 1984, I'm sorry. 1948 are the vice presidential campaigns that I remember. Latin America has a quality, Latin American politics has a quality that we don't have. Outstanding literary and cultural figures are also in Latin America political figures. Carlos Fuentes or García Márquez and others are outstanding literary, cultural, and political figures. And Sergio Ramirez is one of them. I have a feeling that that's kind of nice, that one's approach to political life, to political problems, to political issues, might be deepened and enriched by the effort to carry on a literary or cultural enterprise at the same time. Well, I've spoken long enough. I want to get out of the way and let you hear Sergio Ramirez himself. Thank you for coming, and thank you for being here.
Say thank you very much to Professor Chase for nice words about me, and to say two thanks for this forum, for the invitation to come to speak here before you. It's a very special opportunity for the people of Nicaragua and the government of Nicaragua to express their own point of view about our own situation. Then I must say that I am very pleased to be with you tonight at Harvard. This is one of the greatest centers of legal learning in the world. It is a place where respect for the rule of law among nations as well as among men is not only taught, but practiced, nourished, advocated, and expounded. It is a place where, regardless of prevailing political currents, dedication to supremacy of law remains inviolate. It is particularly appropriate then that I am here at Harvard because I want to talk to you tonight about respect for the rule of law. I want to talk to you about how urgent it is that the nation of the world, large and small, commit themselves to the supremacy of law in their mutual relations. And I want to talk to you about serious present-day threats to the rule of law among nations that, and the dire consequences that will inevitably follow from a rejection of the rule of law. International law guarantees to each state, regardless of size or geopolitical location, the right to self-determination, the right to freely choose its own economic, political, and social systems without any interference or intervention by any other state. International law firmly guarantees to each state its sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence, and prohibits any foreign interference with these basic rights. International law also prohibits the use of armed force by one state against another, with the sole exception of the right to self-defense in the face of an armed attack. Without international law, all of these fundamental rights would disappear. There would be no rights and there would be no justice. Might would substitute for right. Bloodshed and human suffering would multiply, and small states like Nicaragua would remain totally defenseless and at the mercy of their more powerful neighbors. The present international legal order is a fragile one. There is no executive authority or standing international police force empowered to enforce compliance with international law. It is difficult, if not impossible, to physically compel a state to honor its international legal obligations. Compliance is essentially voluntary. Nevertheless, for the most part, states do comply with international law. They do so because they recognize that the consequences of ignoring or disregarding the law can be catastrophic. If one state, particularly a powerful and influential one, rejects the law and the obligations it imposes, then other states are encouraged to follow this example. Soon, there is a generalized breakdown in respect for and compliance with international law. Every time a state rejects or ignores international law, it encourages a dangerous tendency in which the law of justice is replaced by the law of the strongest, that is to say, the law of the jungle. This cannot serve the interests of any civilized state. Thus, when the highest court in the world, the International Court of Justice, renders a decision defining international law or applying it to a particular case, it is incumbent on all the states interested in preserving and maintaining the international legal order to support that decision. The judges of the court, who represent the diverse legal systems of the world, are among the most eminent and respected scholars and experts in the fields of international law. They are men of high moral standing and objectivity. Their decisions are not only legally binding on the parties who appear before them, but they constitute statements and interpretations of law that must be respected by all nations. On June 27, 1986, the International Court of Justice rendered its decision in the case of Nicaragua versus the United States of America. After 26 months of argument, evidence, and careful deliberation, the court pronounced upon the merits of the case. The decision now forms part of the body of international law. In its principal findings, the court ruled that the United States, I quote, by training, arming, equipping, financing, and supplying the contra forces, or otherwise encouraging, supporting, and aiding military and paramilitary activities in and against Nicaragua, has acted against the Republic of Nicaragua in breach of its obligation under customary international law not to intervene in the affairs of another state. End of the quoting. The court also ruled that the United States, by carrying out certain air and naval attacks against Nicaraguan territory by means of United States Armed Force and intelligence personnel, I quote, has acted against the Republic of Nicaragua in breach of its obligation under customary international law not to use force against another state. The court also ruled that by laying mines in the international territorial waters of the Republic of Nicaragua, the United States has acted against the Republic of Nicaragua in breach of its obligation under customary international law not to use force against another state, not to intervene in its affairs, not to violate its sovereignty, and not to interrupt peaceful maritime commerce. The court also ruled that by preparing and disseminating to the contra forces the field manual called Psychological Operations in Guerrilla Warfare, the infamous CIA murder manual, the United States actively encouraged acts of terrorism against innocent civilians. The court also ruled that there was no lawful justification for any of these activities. It expressly rejected, I quote, the justification of collective self-defense maintained by the United States of America in connection with the military and paramilitary in and against Nicaragua. As a result of these rulings, the court ordered the United States to immediately cease and desist from all of these illegal activities and to pay reparations to Nicaragua for the damage it has suffered. It is important to emphasize that on each of these points, the vote of the court was nearly unanimous. On certain points, the vote was 14 against 1, with the United States judge being the sole dissenting vote. On the issue of United States encouragement of acts of terrorism against innocent civilians, even the United States judge voted to condemn the United States. On other points, the vote was 12 against 3. But even here, only the North American judge supported the US position. The judges from Great Britain and Japan declined to join the majority only because they believed that the court lacked jurisdiction, not because they agree with the government of the United States. The court's 142-page opinion is a model of legal scholarship and judicial solemnity and objectivity. The court carefully consider each of the arguments advanced by the United States to justify to the world, and most particularly to the United States public opinion, its intervention and use of force against Nicaragua. After a careful analysis, the court rejected all these arguments. The principal argument of the United States has been that its actions against Nicaragua constitute collective self-defense, because Nicaragua, by supposedly sending arms to the Salvadoran rebels, is engaged in an armed attack against El Salvador. The court found this argument to be totally without foundation. First, the court ruled that the proof offered by the United States to the court, to international organizations, and to the public at large was insufficient to satisfy the court that the government of Nicaragua was responsible for any flow of arms to the Salvadoran rebels. The court thus rejected the very basis of the United States charges against Nicaragua. In the same way, it rejected the thesis that, that Nicaragua is exporting revolution to its Central American neighbors. The court also considered that the argument of the United States that Nicaragua has defaulted on certain commitments it supposedly made to the OAS regarding its internal political system, and that Nicaragua has instead established a communist totalitarian dictatorship that does not respect human rights. The court first found that Nicaragua never made any binding legal commitments to the OAS regarding its internal political system. But the court indicated that even if these commitments would have been made, Nicaragua has complied with them. The court expressly stated that in November of 1984, Nicaragua held elections for president, vice president, and a national assembly, and that seven political parties participated, and that these elections were monitored by international observers. The court also noted that Nicaragua carried out its promise to invite and receive representatives of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, who were permitted to conduct a full on-site investigation of human rights practices in Nicaragua and report on their findings. Finally, the court found that even if a legal commitment to the OAS had been made, and even if it had been broken, this, I quote, could not have justified the United States insisting on the fulfillment of a commitment made not directly toward the United States, but toward the organization, the latter being alone empowered to monitor its implementation. In what may constitute the most important paragraph of its decision, the court declared that the United States' dissatisfaction with Nicaragua's political, social, and economic system could never give rise to a right to intervene in Nicaragua's internal affairs, a strong and eloquent affirmation of the principle of state sovereignty was manifest by the court in the following language. However, the regime in Nicaragua be defined adherence by a state to any particular doctrine does not constitute a violation of customary international law. To hold otherwise would make nonsense of the fundamental principle of state sovereignty on which the whole of international law rests. The court cannot contemplate the creation of a new rule opening up the right of intervention by one state against another on the ground that the latter has opted for some particular ideology or political system. The final argument of the United States considered by the court was the supposed excessive militarization of Nicaragua. This argument was, of course, equally inconsistent, given at the same time the United States was intervening militarily in your internal affairs and carrying out armed attacks against our vital economic installations and mining our ports. It was complaining about our acquisition of the necessary arms to defend ourselves against these illegal activities. It is natural then that the court would have rejected this argument, stating, It is irrelevant and inappropriate, in the court's opinion, to pass upon this allegation of the United States, since in international law there are no rules other than such rules as might be accepted by the state concerned by treaty or otherwise, whereby the level of armament of a sovereign state can be limited, and this principle is valid for all states without exception. When Nicaragua filed this historic lawsuit in April of 1984, our foreign minister, Father Miguel Descoto, announced that we were taking this step to vindicate the inquestionable right of the Nicaraguan people to their sovereignty and self-determination, so that they could secure their own economic and social development free from all intervention. Father Descoto said our intent was not only to vindicate Nicaragua's right, but to confirm, reestablish, and reinforce the right of small states, and particularly of all non-aligned states, to sovereignty, to political independence, and to territorial integrity. He said that Nicaragua was filing this lawsuit to support and strengthen the rule of law in international relations. However, by going to the International Court of Justice, Nicaragua was not only seeking the vindication of its legal rights, but also was accepting its legal obligations. In law, there are no rights without corresponding obligations. We can only insist on our rights under the law if we accept the obligation that the law imposes on us. By submitting ourselves to the jurisdiction and authority of the International Court of Justice, we committed ourselves in the most solemn and irrevocable manner to honor the obligation imposed by the court, whatever the court would have decided, and to honor the obligations imposed on us by international law. This remains Nicaragua's policy, and it will always be so. We have committed ourselves voluntarily and irrevocably to respect and obey international law, and we will continue to honor this commitment. Nicaragua's respect for the rule of law applies not only to international law, but to domestic law as well. Indeed, it is my thesis that a nation, like an individual, either respects the rule of law or does not. If it does, then it will hold the law supreme in both its foreign and domestic affairs. If not, it will respect the rule of law in neither. 4 days ago, the National Assembly adopted in Nicaragua a new constitution for our republic. The new constitution, which I urge you to read and study, establishes the supremacy of the rule of law in Nicaragua. It guarantees a democratic and pluralistic form of government for the Nicaraguan people. There is a clear separation of powers between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government. The executive, consisting of a president and vice-president, and the national legislature, will be chosen every 6 years by direct elections of the people, based on universal suffrage and secret ballot. The judiciary will be independent. Our Supreme Court, like yours, will have the power to declare void any unconstitutional laws or decrees. The fundamental rights and liberties guaranteed by your Bill of Rights are also guaranteed by our new constitution. These include freedom of speech, religion, assembly, and the press. They also include the right to due process of law and freedom from arbitrary arrest or imprisonment. Our constitution guarantees political pluralism in Nicaragua, which means a multiplicity of political parties of differing ideologies, a mixed economy, which means respect for private property and enterprise, and non-alignment, which means we will never allow any foreign military bases in our soil or join any military bloc. Our constitution also guarantees basic social and economic rights to the Nicaraguan people, including the right to education, decent housing, employment, and health care. I do not wish to hide from you the fact that, at present, certain individual rights and liberties guaranteed by our constitution are suspended by our state of emergency. This is something we were compelled to impose, and we did it with great reluctance and sadness. However, the reality is we are confronted with a war being waged on us by a superpower 100 times our size, a war that has already cost us 35,000 lives, many of them civilians and many of those small children, and more than $2 billion in damage to our economy. We know that the tactics used against us include the exploitation of our own liberties and democratic process to destabilize and ultimately overthrow our elected government. They are the same tactics used successfully against President Arbenz in Guatemala and President Allende in Chile. We will not allow them to do the same to us. In any event, our emergency measures are mild compared to those employed by President Abraham Lincoln when faced with an insurgency that was not even directed by a foreign power. Whether you agree or not with our imposition of a state of emergency, you should know that it is only temporary. It will end the same day the war of aggression against us ends. On that day, the full panoply of democratic liberties guaranteed by our Constitution will be unreservedly enjoyed. No one looks for war to that day with greater hope and longing than we. If the United States administration really wants a law-abiding and democratic society in Nicaragua, let him demonstrate his own commitment to the rule of law and stop this illegal war against our people. Travels in the United States, I have been impressed by many things about the North American people. Chief among them is the reverence the North American people have for the law. You are among the most respectful of law of any people in the world. It is sad that the present administration in Washington does not fully reflect this admirable trait. The illegal war the administration continues to wage against my people, which includes deliberate acts of terrorism against innocent civilians, is unworthy of the North American people. The rejection of international law, the flouting of the International Court of Justice, likewise, are acts inconsistent with what I believe is the character of the North American people. These acts do irreparable damage to international law. If the United States, the most powerful nation on earth, rejects the rule of law and ignores the court, why expect anyone else to behave better? But the damage is not confined merely to the rule of law in the international relations. When a government disrespects international law, it is a short step to disrespect for all law, including its own domestic law. Indeed, recent history teaches us that when governments violate international law to achieve illegal foreign policy objectives, they inevitably proceed to violate their own domestic law as well. We can see elements of the same pattern today. Pursuit of an illegal foreign policy objective, the overthrow of the Nicaraguan government in total disregard of international law has led the present administration to disregard its own laws. I refer in particular to violations of prohibitions placed by the U.S. Congress on the amount and nature of U.S. government assistance to the Contras, and violations of the neutrality acts by private persons acting at the request of senior government officials. Indeed, the virus continues to spread. In recent days, we have read that the same senior government officials responsible for carrying on the illegal war against Nicaragua have violated other U.S. laws in connection with other foreign policy objectives in other parts of the world. But it is not the end of the story. As a writer of stories, I know that the end of this one has not been written yet. The North American people, according to all the public opinion polls, overwhelmingly oppose the illegal war against Nicaragua. The North American people, and I don't need any public opinion polls to tell me this, overwhelmingly oppose blatant disrespect for the rule of law and will not in the long term support a policy that repudiates the law. As lawyers, indeed as the elite of your noble profession, you can play a large part in determining how the story ends. You can use your influence and authority to insist that your government respect international law and abide by the ruling of the International Court of Justice. I cannot speak to you as a fellow North American, but I can speak to you as a fellow American and as a fellow lawyer. Let us work together hand in hand to bring this tragic war to an end. Let us work together to build a new relationship between our two countries based on mutual respect, cooperation and friendship, for this is the kind of relationship Nicaragua wants with the United States. And let us work together to foster respect for the rule of law, for only through law can we build a world that is just and at peace. Thank you very much.
Questions now, alternating, and again, please keep the questions brief. Thank you. Start over here.
Excellency, I would like to welcome you again to Harvard and thank you for coming and giving us your remarks here. But my question concerns Mr. Ismael Reyes, who was president of the Nicaraguan Red Cross. In 1983, Mr. Reyes said, "In the American continent, there is no regime more barbaric and bloody, no regime that violates human rights in a manner more constant and permanent than the Sandinista regime." So I wonder how you can come here and talk about human rights in the face of denunciation from your own people.
Okay. Well, the unseen president of the Red Cross in Nicaragua is Mr. Ismael Reyes, who is now living in Miami, Florida. He was not only president of the Red Cross, but he was involved in other activities completely out of this humanitarian role of being president of the Red Cross, but it is not the problem, it is not the question. I was reading a resolution of the International Court of Justice that has a deal too with human rights violations in Nicaragua. And we have had many reports on the part of international organizations that deal with human rights in the world, American Watch, Amnesty International, the International Commission of Jurists of Geneva, and in no one of those reports there is any accusation that we systematically violate human rights in the massive form human rights are violated in Central America. Never has been us accused of disappearances of teachers, workers, labor union leaders, peasants, priests. Never have been us being never have been us accused of killing bishops. There has been a bishop killed in Central America by murders, by Nicaraguan murders, because Monsignor Romero in El Salvador was executed by all members of the National Guard of Somoza. And of course, we are not ashamed of that fact because they were never Nicaraguans. But we have never killed a bishop in Nicaragua. In the last 4 years, more than 70 priests have disappeared in Central America. They have been killed, disappeared. No one of those priests have disappeared in Nicaragua. Then I would say that in spite of the fact that Mr. Ismael Reyes has his own opinion about human rights violations in Nicaragua, we really are not ashamed of the respect we have for human rights in Nicaragua. International commissions are permanently coming to the countries to see things directly. And we always invite human rights commissions to come to the country. We don't have anything to hide from any international commission on the subject of human rights in Nicaragua.
Mr. Ramirez, your own permanent commission on human rights of Nicaragua would seem to disagree with what you say. They're an independent organization, of course, and they've estimated that there are presently 6,500 political prisoners in your country, not including over 2,000 former National Guardsmen, which are imprisoned. This compares with 600 political prisoners in Somoza's day. According to refugees and former prisoners, your Sandinistas employ brutal methods of torture, which include placement in neck-deep sewage pits, multiple rape, attack by trained dogs, and prolonged forced staring into the sun. How does a regime with your abominable human rights record dare speak of invoking the rule of civilized law?
Which kind of report are you, from what report are you extracting those, that information?
Well, there are a series of reports which were done by the Permanent Commission and compiled by Wesley Smith.
Which commission?
The Permanent Commission on Human Rights. It's an independent watchdog organization that is based in Nicaragua.
Based in Nicaragua?
Yes.
Okay, it is the same commission which Mr. Ismael Rey was member of the board to before leaving the country. I would like you to give me notice of any international, independent international commission that have came to Nicaragua to investigate human rights, have given any report accusing Nicaragua of massive violation of human rights. I would like to know.
So you're saying that your own people are incapable of...
It is not the problem of being our own people, I'm sorry, because it is not an independent human rights commission. It is a commission financed by right-wing North American organizations. they are political organizations, partisan organizations, anti-Sandinist organizations, and then they don't have any independence of mind to judge human rights violations in Nicaragua. This is an organization financed by Prodenca, for example. This is a foundation or something like that in the United States, by the Institute for Freedom and Religious Freedom and Liberty, or something like that. And all of those organizations have political aims to war Nicaragua. It is a very clear game. But I insist that international human rights commissions are welcome in Nicaragua, always.
Yes. How can you call the Nicaraguan elections free and fair when Bayardo Arce, one of your own 9 Sandinista comandantes, was secretly tape-recorded as saying, "We believe that the elections should be used in order to vote for Sandinismo, in order to be able to demonstrate that the Nicaraguan people are for totalitarianism, that the Nicaraguan people are for Marxist-Leninism. The people will ratify in a bourgeois-type exercise this Sandinismo, which is Marxism, which is totalitarianism, and which means the spread of Soviet-Cuban influence."
Mm. Please, could you let me to know who secretly taped Commander Arce?
This was printed in... this was on a... secretly tape recorded on November 4th, 1984. This was published in a Spanish newspaper in Barcelona, La Vanguardia.
No, but who taped it?
I'm unsure.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question then. Because I didn't come here to talk about secret taping. We haven't had yet our Watergate in Nicaragua. I am committed here to answer serious questions.
It is serious. That's a convenient answer.
I am not going to engage here in futile discussions about secret tapings. It is not serious for me. I am here in the most prestigious law forum in the world. And how can I discuss about secret taping? It is not serious. Sorry.
Good evening, Mr. Vice President. I was impressed by your remarks concerning your strong commitment to the rule of law. However, in recent years, you have been quoted as expressing fraternal solidarity with Gaddafi's Libya. My question to you is this. Do you continue to hold those views of strong support for Gaddafi's Libya? And if so, how do you reconcile that with your continued insistent calls for a civil dialogue with the United States, as well as your strong support of the rule of law as being imperative for civil dialogue among all the nations of the earth?
Well, we have diplomatic relations with Libya. So we have diplomatic relations with the United States, still, we have. And we have, I would say, a very good kind of relation. But even when we didn't have diplomatic relations with Libya, we have condemned the bombing of Libya by North American planes. It is not necessary to be too close to Libya, and we are not too close to condemn such acts against humanity, against indefensed people, like was the case of the bombing of Tripoli. This is the things we are against, and we hope that we are not going to be the victims of a bombing against Managua in the future. This is what we are trying to avoid, trying to bring the United States to accept the rule of the International Court of Justice. I don't know if you are satisfied with my response or the one I...
Did you...
You want me to elaborate our relationship?
Well, sir, I would just suggest regarding state-sponsored terrorism, did you have similarly vehement feelings towards the assassination of the soldier in the Berlin nightclub. That is, I regret to say that I was not following what you said. I understand about what you said about the bombing of Libya, but what about the assassination of the soldier in Berlin, which was linked conclusively to...
We are against any kind of assassination because we are victims of assassination every day in Nicaragua. I'm not here to justify any kind of assassination. You are satisfied. Okay.
Mr. Vice President, I was very impressed with your background in the 1960s as a leading writer and artist in the progressive movement in Nicaragua. And given this background, how can you associate yourself today with the regime, which has distinguished itself by closing down La Prensa, the main newspaper in Nicaragua, and also by closing down the Radio Católica, the Catholic radio station? And please don't answer by referring to what Abraham Lincoln did.
Well, I have already explained that we have been taking exception measures in our country to confront the situation of war. And I was not hiding those circumstances when I came here to speak before you. It is a sad situation for us. We are against any kind of limitation again on freedoms in our country and elsewhere. We only wait for the United States to cease the war of aggression against Nicaragua that has introduced in the country different kind of interferences in our economic, political, and social life to cease any kind of restriction. I promise you to come here again once the United States has ceased every kind of aggressive actions against my country to declare you that we don't have no more restrictions on any kind of freedom in Nicaragua and that La Prensa would be functioning again after the United States ceased this war of aggression against Nicaragua.
Mr. Vice President, you seem to have a great deal of concern for innocent civilians. However, a recent report reveals that a genocidal program has been carried out by your government.
Genocidal what?
A genocidal program has been carried out by your government against the Mosquitos Indians in Nicaragua. Over half the tribe has been murdered by Sandinista forces, and the survivors have been herded into an area less than half the size they previously occupied. What is the justification for this?
There is any kind of evidence about that, what you are saying. This is a fabrication, an old fabrication, of the 1980-91 against the revolution. No one has been able to demonstrate that we are murderers, that we are assassins, that we are genocides against the mosquito population in Nicaragua. We recognize that in the past we have had problems, political problems, with the mosquito population. Just because we made an erroneous approach to the mosquito problem in the Atlantic coast at the moment when we were trying to change all the old structures of the country, including the social and economic structures of the mosquito population. We were a mistake. We didn't take into consideration the own opinions of the mosquito population. We corrected our way, and now we are working together with them, trying to find a way out of their poverty and backwardness in a region of the country that has always been isolated from the rest of Nicaragua. I am recognizing that we were a mistake, that we didn't make the correct approach to the problem of the mosquito population, but from that point to the assertion that we are murderers and that we are genocide, there is an enormous distance.
Mr. Vice President, perhaps it need be said, given the tenor of the question so far, that there are many of us in this room who feel that the mining of the Nicaraguan harbors and the funding of the Contras are one of the more deplorable actions taken by the United States in the last 25 to 50 years. When I ask myself why is it that these policies carry any support in the American people, it seems to me that the only explanation is that the current administration has been able to paint the Sandinista government as a government unwilling to take serious actions to try to solve the current upheaval in the region. And with that in mind, I ask you, what is your government's position on the Contadora peace process, which has been trying to be started by other nations in South Central America to try to bring a resolution not involving the United States? And to the extent that you don't feel that that is the proper vehicle, I wonder if you could tell us what vehicle you would think would be a proper way to resolve some of these current problems.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. We have been engaged in the Contadora process since the beginning. We have been trying very hard to get concrete results out of the negotiations carried out by Contadora. It has been a very difficult and painful process, negotiations. I would say first, without elaborating before elaborating about your question, that the permanent interference of the government of the United States has avoided until now any result for the efforts of the Contadora group. Because it's logical that if the government of the United States is looking for a violent solution of the problems of Central America, and if the government of the United States is only interested in overthrowing our government by force, it is impossible that this government would be interested in a peaceful solution through proposals like the ones that Contadora has presented to the Central American countries. This is the main cause of interference in the Contadora process. We have been seriously interested in the success of the Contadora effort because we are the most affected country in Central America because of the crisis of the region. We are suffering a tremendous war and we are amidst this problem and we want peace. And we believe that the only vehicle, the only way to get peace in Central America is Contadora, because it is a Latin American group, because it represents Central American interests. And we believe really that there is not another way out of the crisis but Contadora. In 1984, we were the only country in Central America to accept the first proposal of Contadora for an act of peace that contemplated the pull out of all foreign military advisors from the region, including the one that we have in Nicaragua, the ones that we have in Nicaragua, without exception. This draft for an agreement contemplated too that all military bases in Central America should be closed down. We don't have military bases in Nicaragua then, but we were in agreement that all the military bases in the region must be closed down. We accepted too that all military maneuvers, military exercises in Central America must cease immediately after the signing of the act. And we accepted then that a complete surveillance of illegal activities in the borders between Central American countries must be established to avoid the trafficking of arms and men from one country to another to try to destabilize countries in Central America. And we agreed too that an international commission of supervision must be empowered to act and to observe that those things will be really executed. That was in 1984. Then it was not possible to sign this act because Honduras, El Salvador, and Costa Rica opposed the signing of the act. And we started a new round of negotiations. New countries in Latin America came to participate in Contadora, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Peru. Then Contadora was based in a most widened spectrum of countries interested in peace in Central America. There was a new chance, a good chance to achieve peace in the region. And Contadora presented a new draft of agreement to the Central American countries in April or May 1986. And this agreement contemplated, in addition to the points I have already mentioned, that a limitation of arms and men must be imposed on all Central American armies. And we accepted that too. Not only we presented to Contadora a list of our proposal for the reduction of offensive weapons in the region. And we were in accordance that the size of the armies in Central America must be reduced to try to achieve peace in a demilitarized Central America without foreign military bases, without foreign military advisors. In May 1986, in June 1986, Nicaragua was again the only country to accept this draft and to announce officially its disposition to sign this agreement. And again, we were alone. No other Central American country except Guatemala accepted to sign this agreement. And now, not only Honduras and Costa Rica and El Salvador have stated that they are not going to participate, that they are not going to sign the agreement, but that they are not going to participate anymore in the Contadora negotiations just because Nicaragua decided to sue them before the International Court of Justice. It is a pretext, only a pretext. We don't see that suing Costa Rica and Honduras before the International Court of Justice would be an offense for those countries. But it is the situation in this moment. We continue to support Contadora, and we are going to do so in the future because I insist we believe that it is the only way out of the crisis in Central America.
Mr. Vice President, I got a message for you, man. Nicaragua va a ser libre de nuevo. Vivan las contras, baby. Vivan las contras. I love you all too, I do.
Do you have a question?
Very academic intervention. No more questions. Please.
We've got time for a couple more.
Is this working? Mr. Vice President, if by some chance the United States would do as some of us wish and comply with international law and not remove all intervention from Nicaragua, I ask you, what would your government do with the Contras who were left unaided by any more American aid? And do you have any plan to restore all rights of citizenship to them, or treat them as political prisoners? How would you deal with the Contras if this were to happen?
Well, we have in Nicaragua an amnesty law that was approved by the National Assembly 2 years ago. This amnesty law contemplates that any counter-revolutionary armed people that put down their arms come under the benefit of this law and they can return to the country, or if they are in the country, they can't live in peace without any restriction. And now, after 2 years of the implementation of this law, more than 1,500 counter-revolutionaries have abandoned their arms, laid down their arms, and have been integrated to the civil life in Nicaragua. Then I think that is the best way for anybody that wants peace in Nicaragua to integrate to our society without any restriction. This is our way to deal with counter-revolutionary forces. To negotiate in political terms with them, it is not possible because they are not more than, well, I wouldn't say a federal agency of the United States, but something like an office or a department. And in this case, it is better to negotiate with the government of the United States to settle peace in Nicaragua. This is our position, and we are insisting in a serious negotiation with the government of the United States. Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Vice President, first of all, I think we should all be flattered as Americans that you have expressed your belief that we have a high respect for law. Unfortunately, I believe this must mean that you've not had the opportunity to operate an automobile on the streets of Boston. Let me be a little more serious. If we take due account of Professor Shea's cautions regarding the expressions, of the intentions that the United States may express toward Latin American countries, can we suppose for a moment, by some small miracle, that the United States would adopt a position of what we might call benign neglect, if not active support, of a Sandinista-led government in Nicaragua? Could you tell us how the development of Nicaraguan society would differ over the succeeding 7 years from how it has been for the past 7 years?
Well, this is like to dream. I think that in a very hypothetical situation, without war, we wouldn't be spending 50% of our national budget in war. As now. Without war, we'll be dedicated to produce food for our people. We can't not do that in the extent we would like to now because of the war. We wouldn't have inflation in the country because financing war implies inflation because we are printing Cordovas in Nicaragua to finance the war. Nobody's financing this war in the world but the Nicaraguan people. With its own work. This is the situation. And with peace, we will have a state of complete normality in the country. We wouldn't have any kind of restrictions on civil liberties and human civil liberties and freedoms. We will have a complete freedom for the press. We'll have periodical elections in our country. We are going to have them in any case, with or without war. And then we'll be consolidating a new democratic system in Latin America that could be an example for many other countries in our continent that are in need of changes. Because the problem in Latin America that is that we are open to a process of changes that necessarily are going to be given in Latin America. And to try to avoid those changes is nonsense because they are going to be produced any a way or another. In any case, what is important in Nicaragua is that even when we think that we must achieve peace to carry out a political project that like the one you have asked me about, even amidst a situation of war where we are carrying out a democratic project for our country. Thank you.
My question is related to your response. The word democracy, I think, is a significant element of the ideology surrounding U.S. foreign policy towards Central America. And I think, in particular, the U.S. public has the impression that democracy is something that the United States has a corner on. I know also that participatory democracy is a strong element of the ideology of the Nicaraguan Revolution. And I think you could clarify for us what are the similarities and the differences between the U.S. concept of democracy and the Nicaraguan concept of participatory democracy.
Well, we would like to have in Nicaragua, without trying to make any comparison with the system you have in the United States, we would like to have a real democratic system, a participatory system that means that people effectively participate in democracy. We will be very disappointed if in our elections, for example, only 30% of the voters went to the polls. That wouldn't be for us a real democracy. And we stimulate people to participate not only in elections, but in every act that would be related to democratic actions in Nicaragua. For us, democracy is, for example, to participate in vaccination campaigns for children, to participate in literacy campaign to educate people, to go to the hills to participate in the coffee harvesting. Those are for us acts that represent the democratic will of the people of Nicaragua, because we don't want to be only a formal democracy, a democracy that is only written in our constitution, but a democracy really practiced every day by our people. And it is what we want to conquer in the future, real participatory democracy for our country. How will I, last remark, before leaving, I want to express a few words of appreciation to our moderator, Professor Chase, in my name and in the name of my government. At the beginning of 1984, when Nicaragua was about to initiate its lawsuit against the government of this country, we recognized the enormity of the task we were about to undertake. While we knew we had truth and justice on our side, we also realized that the U.S. government will have an overwhelming advantage in terms of influence and resources. We knew we need the very best international lawyers to represent us in the court. We knew as well that we need men and women of the highest integrity who would resist all the pressures to which they would be subjected. These considerations led us to Professor Chase. We made the right choice. He's a brilliant advocate and man of unimpeachable integrity. He's also a man of great courage. He's willing to defend the truth, to strive for justice regardless of personal consequences. He sets a high example for his students, his peers, and his fellow citizens. We express our deep gratitude to him. Thank you very much.